on The Book Jump with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, it is our great pleasure to welcome a legend, and not just in his own mind, but in all of our minds, Carl Reiner, who has a new memoir entitled I Remember Me. It's from Author House. Carl Reiner, of course, is one of those men who needs no introduction, but that since that's my job, I'll do it anyway. He was on the writing staff and one of the co-stars of your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar and Eugene Coca. He was the creator and director and occasionally portrayed Alan Brady on The Dick Van Dyke Show. Has an Army career that we want to talk about a little bit and Broadway career we want to talk about a little bit. One of the funniest recordings ever, Mel Brooks and he did The 2,000-Year-Old Man. And he has a great family, wonderful stories about his family. And some of his family you know and some of them you don't know, but you need to get to know them. And that's part of what makes I Remember Me a lovely, lovely book. Carl, thank you so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf.
I just want to ask you a question. That little conversation we just had before where
yes.
I sang with my... Is that, do you have that on? Of course, I'm going to sing it again if you don't have it.
Yes, yes. Oh, I started recording just in case. Yeah, no, I was
good, because I wouldn't want me Irish tenor not to be on your show.
Absolutely. Folks, one of the things that you learn early on in Carl's book is that when he was a little lad, he wanted so much to be an Irish tenor when he grew up, which was a little complicated for him until he discovered about how someone could be one thing in real life and something else on the radio.
Well, you know, it's funny, but when I was a kid, my father loved it. We had a radio in the house. He built the first radio, I think, that was in our neighborhood. And we had to have a storage battery from the garage to power the radio. But he loved this. He loved the particular program. He had a friend, a European friend named Max Kalfus. And Max Kalfus was an Austrian Jewish gentleman. But he had a brother named John Calvin who sang on WR in New York. And we used to listen to that John Calvin, and he'd open every program by saying, "This is John Calvin. I'd like to sing the songs me mother sang to me when I was a wee lad sitting on her knee. Oh, I want to go back to that tumble-down shack where the bright roses bloom around the door." I love that.
Oh, nicely done, sir.
And he'd sing these songs, and I love those songs. And I said, "I want to be that when I grow up. I want to be an Irish tenor." And my father explained to me, "I could sing Irish songs, but I'll be a Jewish tenor singing Irish songs."
Well, speaking on behalf of all the Irish diaspora in America, we would be honored to have you to be an honorary Irishman.
I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Sure enough.
By the way, one of my dearest, dearest best friends, I stayed with an Irish family when my son was born. He was 6 weeks old, and I did a show in Philadelphia. My best friend in the Army is a guy named Joe Coogan. As a matter of fact, I wrote an episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show, The Lives and Loves of Joe Coogan. By the way, Lehigh University asked for that particular episode, and they made a one-act opera out of it.
No kidding.
And, so Joe Coogan and his Irish family, I spent time with, living in a three-family house, and for a couple months. And so I have a very wonderful spot in my heart for Joe Coogan.
Well, now, let's talk a little bit about your career as a soldier in the U.S. U.S. Army Air Corps, right?
Yeah, well, I was in the Army Air Corps first, but I actually, when I finally, I got pneumonia, and then I went to the hospital. When I came out, they put me in the Signal Corps, and I was a member of the Signal Battalion as a teletype operator.
Yeah, and you had to learn Morse code, and then you also went to school to learn French, right?
Yes. After being graduated as a teletype operator, for some reason they sent us to because I had a certain average in high school, 79 actually. I wasn't that bright, but it was as bright as some of the other guys. And they sent us to an Army specialized training program at Georgetown University to study, to speak French and learn the language of the area. And we were going to be interpreters in France. And we were sent to Hawaii after we graduated.
Well, it's good to know that the tradition in the U.S. military continues, that they always are good to train you about things and then send you off to do something completely different.
And you know something? They must know what they're doing because we won the war.
There you go. The proof is in the pudding, so to speak. Early on in your career as a performer and as a writer, you did some Broadway, and there's a great story about how you came to be involved in this Broadway show and how that led to the next step in your career, getting hooked up with Sid Caesar, right?
Yes. The Broadway show, I was in a few Broadway shows before I got to that one. By the way, there was steadily decreasing parts and successes. The first one was right after the war. It was a thing called Call Me Mister. It was a review. I did it for a year, got wonderful notices, and it was raining high. And the second one was a thing called Inside USA with Jack Haley and Bee Lilly. I didn't have as good a part, wasn't as good a show. And the third show I got in was Alive and Kicking, which didn't work at all. It was fair. But what happened is that Max Liebman, who was doing the show of shows at the time, was looking for somebody to be working with Sid Caesar as a straight man, and he came to see the show, and he invited me to come along and be in the show, and be in the television show. So it was one of those lucky happenstances.
Well, now, when you first started writing, for people who haven't ever seen your show of shows that are younger, I'd like you to know that A&E has some collections of your show of shows, and it's just wonderful stuff, just wonderful stuff.
It was actually the first big variety review show with songs, opera, ballet, sketches, in one comedy, and it was the template for all the great shows that followed after that, the best ones being the Carol Burnett Show and finally Saturday Night Live. But that was the precursor to all of those great shows. And it was on for about 4 years, and then I stayed with Sid Caesar for another 5 years on Caesar's Hour, doing an hour version of an hour and a half. It was an hour and a half when we did the shows, then we cut it to an hour.
One of my favorite bits that you guys did was the time that Sid Caesar and Nanette Fabre were playing a couple that had been saving and bought a white goat rug. And it had taken 6 months to get there. And they invite their friends to come see it. And all of a sudden, it starts raining. And you and Howard Shore both came in with the characters' wives to see the rug.
I know. I remember that so well because I remember having to prepare to make this work, and we had to do something, some physical things off stage to make this. We came in with our shoes so wet, they said, take your shoes off before you come in to our white rug. So we took our shoes off. When I walked on the white rug, it seems my socks were black socks, but they were cheap socks, and they ran. So every place I put my foot, there was a blue footmark all over the stage. And I remember having an ink pad in my putting an ink pad inside the sole of my sock underneath that. And I found a way of really making it by hopping. When I got one, and I didn't want to, by hopping, you hit me and hit it harder.
Uh-huh.
I was walking. I was hopping to get off there, you think. And it was hilarious. I haven't seen that since then. Did you see it?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I teach a class at the local university, Troy University, called Orientation to Radio and TV, which is essentially a history of broadcast class.
So I play
old great radio shows for them, and
wow,
I show them excerpts from TV shows that are available on DVD. And I always show them that sketch. These are children who were born 40 or 45 years after you did that sketch, and it knocks them out every time. It is still hysterical.
Gee, I have to look at it. I have to find it. I have the box set someplace. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. I'll do that. Mel comes over every night. I'm sure he'll be happy to help me find it.
There you go. Now, you and Mel Brooks have been friends for how long?
60 years now, starting in 1950. We see each other every night.
As a matter of fact, there's a chapter in the book where you and your families went to Norman Lear's house, and you came up with a great name it's a Yiddish name, I think.
It's a Yiddish, a German name, Jenemwelt, meaning the other world. And we were having such fun. There were five couples, and each one of the couples had at least one hilarious person. And we talk about Larry Gelbart, the guy who wrote MASH, and mm-hmm. Norman Lear with All in the Family, and myself and Nell, and Dom DeLuise, maybe the funniest human being ever, and our wives, who were funny too, and five people living in five bedrooms for a weekend. And we did it two weekends in about 2 or 3 years. We did three or four of those events and never laughed so hard in our lives. And those were memorable events. We called the interval. We had a song even to the tune of...
Oh, Tannenbaum, right.
Yeah. Oh, Yannenbelt, 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 there is no belt like Yannenbelt. That was our theme song, which we made up in 2 seconds. Everything was... ad-libbed in 2 seconds, we just laughed hysterically.
Oh, and Larry Gelbart and Mel Brooks were writers with you and Neil Simon and Woody Allen, among others, on your Show of Shows, correct?
Well, no, Woody Allen was not on your Show of Shows. Now, see, Woody Allen, when we did the Show of Shows, was 12 years old.
Oh, okay. Well,
however,
he could have been precocious. I didn't know.
Yeah. No, what happened when Sid finished his career as he did 9 years with Show of Shows, Caesar's Hour, and Caesar Presents. Now we all went about our business. I started doing movies, and Sid did a series of four specials, when he was, quite a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember coming to visit him, and he said, "Hey, I got a new redheaded writer." We always had one redheaded writer, and there was a little guy sitting in a corner, an 18-year-old boy, and his name is Woody Allen. He's very funny, and we met him, and that was Woody, but he never worked on the show.
So oh, okay.
You have the real information now. This is because many, many people said what you just said. Woody Allen worked. He worked with Sid Caesar, but not on the Show of Shows or Caesar's Hour. He worked on four NBC specials that Sid did, 60s, 70s.
Okay. Well, thank you for straightening that out, because I kind of wondered about his age.
Okay. He was 12 years old when we did.
He's a very smart fellow, but I think even as a 12-year-old, he would have been in pretty tough company with you guys.
He is a true genius, Mr. I consider Woody Allen a genius. And genius is always described by me anyway, by you have to have not only great work, but a volume of it.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare would not have been a genius had he just written Hamlet, but he wrote 37 plays. And Woody Allen, a guy named Alan Ayckbourn in London, has done about 39 plays, all brilliant.
Hmm.
Woody Allen has done like 40 movies, 38, 40 movies. That is genius. And
yes.
Most of them were brilliant.
Yes. And many of those movies started out as hit plays on Broadway before they were transitioned into movies.
Yeah, at the very beginning, yeah.
Yeah.
Played against Sam, and he was a good monologist, too, right before he started doing that.
Right.
He was on the Sullivan Show and places like that.
Let me ask you about your friend Mel Brooks again. I have to admit that I am a huge Mel Brooks fan, and when I was coming of age in the 70s, even before there was Blazing Saddles, there was a TV show that he did called When Things Were Rotten that was a parody of Robin Hood, and I thought,
yes,
this guy is just crazy.
I discovered
Your 2,000-Year-Old Man, and I thought, this is incredible. And tell us about how you guys came to develop this act of the 2,000-year-old man.
You know, it was like it was yesterday. I do remember 1950. This is in the office of Max Liebman, the Show of Shows. He was our producer. My very first day there, Mel Brooks was there at the behest of Sid Caesar. He was a friend of Sid, young comedian who was selling jokes to Sid for $40 a week. He got it from Sid. He wasn't on the show's roster. And he got up. I didn't meet him yet. He stood up, and he did a Jewish pirate, a pirate with a Jewish accent. And I'll never forget those first lines. He said, how expensive sailcloth is to buy today. He says, $3.40 a yard. He says, I can't afford to pillage and rape anymore. I can't afford to set sail. And that was the first words he said. And he went on for about 20 minutes. And I laughed hysterically. It was the following weekend, I watched a thing called We the People Speak with Dan Seymour recreating the news on a Sunday short talk show. They recreated it. And the guy said, here was a man who was in Stalin's toilet, and he heard the premier say, going to blow the world Thursday. I came in and I said, hey, that's a good idea for a sketch, a news show where the guy tells you things that nobody would know. And nobody was interested. But I turned to Mel and I said, here is a man who was actually at the scene of the crucifixion 2,000 years ago. Isn't that true, sir? And I didn't know what Mel was going to say. And he said, oh, boy. I said, you were there? Jesus, right? Yeah, a thin lad, right? He, He always wore sandals, walked around with 12 other guys, came into my store at a candy store, never bought anything, always asked for water. That was his first words. And for the next, believe it or not, for the next 10 years, in the office or at parties or at gatherings, anybody's house, sometimes it was command performances, people would make a party. So Mel and I would get up into the 2,000-year-old man. But we did it only for friends. And everybody kept saying, you've got to put this on record. And we said, no, this is a European Jewish accent, and the war is only 5 years from when it stopped, and Hitler did enough making fun of the Jews. We don't have to make fun of ourselves. We said it's for our friends and for non-antisemitic Gentiles. That's who it's for. Anyway, at one of those parties, after literally 10 years of doing it at parties, 1950 to 1960, we were at one of these, what we call an A-list party, and George Burns was at this party, and these are the three people who came up to us. George Burns, with a cigar in mouth, said, he says, is there a record on that? Do you guys put this on a record? And we said, no. He said, well, put it on a record or I'm going to steal it. That was his line. Edward G. Robinson, the famous old great actor, Robinson, he says, make a play out of that. I'd like to do that play on Broadway. I'd like to play the 1,000-year-old man on Broadway. I said, it's 2,000-year-old man. He said, I can play any age. I never, those are actual words. And the third one was, in his wisdom, Steve Allen, who loved to present new comedians to the world. He said, fellas, I have a studio where I do my recordings, World Pacific Jazz. He says, you can use it. He says, just get a bunch of people together and just wail like you're wailing here and put it on tape. And if you like it, use it. If not, burn it. He says, you can do anything you want. We've got 200 people together, and for two hours, we ad-libbed 2 hours of material, cut it out to 47 minutes, trimmed it up, and it became the 2,000-year-old man. And we did five records, I guess. Wow. And they work. It's now very old. It's from 1960 on, and people are still laughing at it.
Well, when you're talking about a 2,000-year-old man, I mean, a few decades here and there, no big deal. Of course, one of the things, in case you're just joining us, folks, you've been missing out. We're talking to a legendary writer, TV producer, entertainer, Carl Reiner. And, of course, most of the people my age, I'm about the same age as your son, Rob, as boomers, we think of you, we think of the Dick Van Dyke Show, and we think, and I know I had read before your book how you had come up with the idea, shot a pilot, and it didn't go as well as you'd hoped, and so you revamped it and found Dick Van Dyke to be the lead character.
That's worth a moment of fun.
Yes.
After I failed with that pilot, I wrote 13 episodes knowing that I was going to be the star of it. I figured I better have a Bible for the writers who come along to help me.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the pilot, and it wasn't very good. It was okay. It was just fair. But that was a year only horses and the westerns and situation comedies were king that year.
Right.
And I just gave up. I said, that's it. You know, I can't do this. And I went on to write movies. I wrote a movie for Doris Day, The Thrill of It All, another one called The Art of Love. And I was called by my agent. He was bothered that those 13 episodes of a very good show were lying on his desk.
Right.
Fallow. So he called in Sheldon Leonard and Danny Thomas, they were producers at the time, besides having a show on the air. And they read the script, and they called me in, and I said, Sheldon, I'm so pleased to meet you, and I'm glad you like my material, but I got to tell you right now, I don't want to fail twice with the same material. And he said to me, and this is a good impression of Sheldon Leonard, he says, Carl, you won't fail. We'll get a better actor to play you. And he suggested Dick Van Dyke. I went to see him in Bye Bye Birdie in New York, and I saw one of the best actors I've ever seen anywhere. He can do anything, that guy. He's about as good a performer. He's a 10-letter man, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. The Dick Van Dyke Show wins multiple Emmy Awards, garners enormous critical and popular acclaim. After 5 years, You guys make the decision to not make the show anymore because you wanted to leave with it on top, and it certainly was. And one of the things that I like so much about the show is that it's
and
not...
And also, you know, we had done 158 shows. We did 39 a year. Today they do 20, you know, so
right.
You don't get as many. We did 158 shows, and we started to repeat ourselves, and we all started having other places to do things. Mary wanted to go to Broadway. And movies were calling Dick and myself, and so we went out high, and we knew we were going to be good. And you know, the interesting thing is they just came out with a Blu-ray box set of the whole 158 episodes.
Ooh.
And I looked at it the other day. They found the original film, you know, the negative, and they did something to it to make it it's the sharpest black and white movie you'll ever see.
Wow.
You can see every hair on everybody's head, and the tweeds look very tweedy. It's really wonderful that they did that.
Well, one of the great things about the show is that you guys deliberately were trying not to anchor it into one particular time, and therefore it still holds up as a wonderful show. It's still a great show about a man and his wife and his son and his friends and his coworkers and a boss and all of that, and it's still funny. And and the episodes are still wonderful.
You know, one of the things I've been hearing lately, for the last many, many years, young writers will come up to me, or young people come up to me in the street and would say, these are 30, 40-year-old guys, and said, when I was a kid, he says, I used to watch a show with my parents, and I was a funny kid, but I had no interest in, I knew I didn't want to be a comedian, but I knew I said funny things, and I never knew there was a thing called a comedy writer. That so many comedy writers have told me this. He says they thought kids thought comedians made up their own jokes. He says, here's a guy writing for a comedian who does it on the air. And I'm not kidding, at least four dozen people have said this to me. They became a writer because they found out that there's a guy who writes for comedians.
How
and
about
that thrills me more than any. It's a byproduct of what I was doing, but it tickles me.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's like you mentored a whole generation of comedy writers and didn't even realize it at the time. That's wonderful.
But I do remember when I was writing the show and telling writers who were coming into work with me, I said, fellas, no slang of the day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want any slang. A gun is a gun, not a gat. We don't use words like Splitsville, you know, whatever. Those are the words
right.
of the day. And I said, because it's going to date it. And I said, this has a universal appeal that I think is going to last longer than we think, because if we keep the slang out of it and the modern, you know, modern aphorisms. And I think that was a wise direction.
I think you guys were spot on with that. Now, I know our time is getting close, but I wanted to talk to you and ask you to tell us a little bit about your beloved life with your wife, Estelle. And I know that
Well, you know, the book I Remember Me is mainly, it exists because I met a girl when I was 20, and she was 28 years old, and we got married after meeting in the first year of our knowing each other. We got married, but I've said this. She raised three great kids and one great husband. She knew everything. She was the most talented human being I know. She could play tennis. She could throw a ball like a guy. She had two brothers who were athletes, and they taught her how to play. She could sing like a bird. I mean, we have seven albums of hers, which she started singing when she was 60 and went to jazz clubs. But she could paint. She had one-woman shows as an artist. There was nothing this woman couldn't do. She could cook. She could be funny. She was just, she was, you know, my life. And to this day, after 65 years, there was a moment I don't think about her. But she really made me, and I do spend a lot of time in the book writing about her. And as a matter of fact, the last chapter in the book called The End, somebody talked about that yesterday. They brought over a tape that I had this book, I Remember Me. I was at a woman's club, and they asked me to read something in the book. And I read a couple things for them before it was published. And I read the last chapter called The End, where my wife passed away. And somebody filmed it. It was 50 women in a room bawling their eyes out.
Aww.
And but it was one of the sweetest goodbyes anybody's ever said. Should I tell it to you?
Certainly.
Well, my wife was sick for quite a while, and she stayed in her bedroom for the last year. All her senses were with her. We had people there for dinner. Milk used to come up for dinner and friends come up then, but she was bedridden. And she was 94, and when she was ready to go, we all knew we had the hospice there, and all the children, the three children, and her dear nephew, George, was there. And we sat around for almost half a day, and she quietly expired. And at the last hour or two, she was making no sounds. We were talking to her. We didn't know she could hear us. We were pretty sure she could, but there was no indication that she could. And then in the last hour, her breathing was almost imperceptible. It was a breath every minute or so, a little bit of breath in and out, and then none. And then we were feeling the carotid artery. It was a little tiny, tiniest of pulses. And I got the idea. I said, let's put on her last album, Adult Songs for Children. It's a beautiful album where she sings songs that kids would like that they would never know. Adult songs, but orchestrated for kids. And I think one of the songs was, Hey, You're Adorable, B. You're so... And I said, let's play it up high, loud, so she'll hear her voice as she leaves us. And we're all sitting on her bed, and every one of us is, you know, looking at her and talking to her, and no reaction at all. In the last 15 minutes, there wasn't there was no air coming in or out of her mouth, but we knew she was not gone yet. But the song was playing, and Lucas, our young son, went right up to his mother, and he said, oh, the hospice nurse said, she has such a lovely, sweet voice, as the voice was coming over the speaker. And he said it right into her face, Ma, she says you have such a lovely, sweet voice. And we would not know she had heard it, except the moment before she expired, she mouthed the words, thank you. She didn't say it. We didn't hear it, but we could see the lips making, the lips and tongue saying, thank you. And she went out. I mean, you can't ask for a better exit with all your family there who have just told her. Well, for the whole week, we were telling her, you know, how much she meant to us, and she knew she was going. Yeah. Anyway, that's what I want to say. And at the end of I call that last thing the end, and then I wrote another chapter saying there's no end to the living. If you wake up the next day thinking about your wife and also what you're going to have for breakfast, you're still alive, and she's alive because I'm alive.
Right.
Because
as long...
she's in me and never will leave until I go.
There you go. As long as there's somebody who remembers you, you don't leave for good.
And by the way, you know, I Remember Me, somebody just reminded me to tell you, there's an e-book on I Remember Me that really, I just saw it. It's so wonderful. These guys put together things that you can hear songs and I don't know where they got all this stuff. Films, well, they got it from my archives, but they looked into the films of my kids in our houses in New Rochelle, dancing, and all even my dogs are in that.
Oh, wow. That is remarkable. If people would like to get a copy of your book, and I know you're, before the interview airs, because it's going to air the first part of April, that you're going to have your 91st birthday on the 20th of March. And so I'd like to be among the first people to wish you a happy 91st birthday.
Well, thank you very much. And I wish I could give every one of you people listeners a free book, but we don't do that.
That's
Oprah does that.
And
Ellen DeGeneres does. That's right. Maybe I'll go on Ellen's show. You can buy some books.
There you go. Well, now, how do people go to authorhouse.com to or Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and so forth?
Yeah, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. And wherever if you have computers, you can find it.
All right. Wonderful. Carl Reiner, our very special guest today on the bookshelf. His new book is memoir, I Remember Me. It's from Author House, and you can find it anywhere.
Dave, you're very good. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, sir. It's a great honor for me. I've been a fan of yours for so long, and I was so delighted when the publicity stuff came out. I thought, well, Carl Reiner, he's not going to have time to talk to me, but I'm going to ask anyway. And when the publicist says, well, yeah, I think we can fit you in, I thought, wait till I tell my family. They're going to be so excited for me.
Well, I'm excited, too. And I leave you with a song that we know.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Johnny boy, the pipes at Carlin.
Ah, quit. You'll make me cry now.
Down the mountainside. All right.
Well, thank you. Right. Thank you again so much.
Okay, bye, Doc.
Bye-bye. the legendary Carl Reiner, our guest today on The Book Show. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless.